From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The acting Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, said his country is not discussing membership in NATO. Speaking with reporters after meeting with NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen in Brussels on Thursday, Yatsenyuk said, quote, "It is not on our radar," closed quote, adding that no military options are being considered in Kiev. Yatsenyuk also said he had invited NATO representatives to visit Kiev. However, according to a report from the Ukrainian Interfax news agency, Ukraine's ambassador to Belarus, Mykhailo Yezhel, said that the possible deployment of U.S. missile defense components on Ukrainian territory in exchange for U.S. financial support to Kiev is a subject of negotiations. Speaking in Minsk of the possible deployment of the components as a condition of financial support, Ambassador Yezhel, who is the former minister of defense of Ukraine, said to reporters Wednesday, quote, "This is a subject of negotiations. As they say, shoot first and ask questions later," closed quote. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama announced Thursday that he had issued an executive order establishing a series of sanctions against certain, as yet unspecified, Russian and Crimean officials to be imposed at his discretion. The order reportedly authorizes sanctions against, quote, "individuals and entities responsible for activities undermining democratic processes or institutions in Ukraine," closed quote. He then said that the referendum scheduled on the future status of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian constitution and would not be recognized by Washington.
Good afternoon, everybody. Before Jay takes some of your questions, I wanted to provide a brief update on our efforts to address the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Since the Russian intervention, we've been mobilizing the international community to condemn this violation of international law and to support the people and government of Ukraine. This morning, I signed an executive order that authorizes sanctions on individuals and entities responsible for violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine or for stealing the assets of the Ukrainian people. According to my guidance, the State Department has also put in place restrictions on the travel of certain individuals and officials. These decisions continue our efforts to impose a cost on Russia and those responsible for the situation in Crimea. And they also give us the flexibility to adjust our response going forward based on Russia's actions. We took these steps in close coordination with our European allies. I've spoken to several of our closest friends around the world, and I'm pleased that our international unity is on display at this important moment. Already, we've moved together to announce substantial assistance for the government in Kiev. And today in Brussels, our allies took similar steps to impose costs on Russia. I am confident that we are moving forward together, united in our determination to oppose actions that violate international law and to support the government and people of Ukraine. And that includes standing up for the principle of state sovereignty. The proposed referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian constitution and violate international law. Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine. In 2014, we are well beyond the days when borders can be redrawn over the heads of democratic leaders. While we take these steps, I want to be clear that there is also a way to resolve this crisis that respects the interests of the Russian Federation, as well as the Ukrainian people. Let international monitors into all of Ukraine, including Crimea, to ensure the rights of all Ukrainians are being respected, including ethnic Russians. Begin consultations between the government of Russia and Ukraine with the participation of the international community. Russia would maintain its basing rights in Crimea, provided that it abides by its agreements and respects Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And the world should support the people of Ukraine as they move to elections in May. That's the path of de-escalation. And Secretary Kerry is engaged in discussions with all of the relevant parties, including Russia and Ukraine, to pursue that path. But if this violation of international law continues, the resolve of the United States and our allies and the international community will remain firm. Meanwhile, we've taken steps to reaffirm our commitment to the security and democracy of our allies in Eastern Europe and to support the people of Ukraine. One last point. There's been a lot of talk in Congress about these issues. Today, once again, I'm calling on Congress to follow up on these words with action, specifically to support the IMF's capacity to lend resources to Ukraine and to provide American assistance for the Ukrainian government so that they can weather this storm and stabilize their economy, make needed reforms, deliver for their people, all of which will provide a smoother pathway for the elections that have already been scheduled in May. Today, the world can see that the United States is united with our allies and partners in upholding international law and pursuing a just outcome that advances global security and the future that the Ukrainian people deserve. That's what we're going to continue to do in the days to come until we have seen a resolution to this crisis. Thanks very much. And Jay and Ben and others will be happy to take your questions.
President Obama's rejection of the announced referendum on Crimea's future on constitutional grounds stands in stark contrast to his recognition of the present de facto government in Kiev, which seized power after purporting to depose the elected president without following the Constitution's requirements of impeachment. Nevertheless, in the press conference which followed the president's remarks, not a single reporter asked Press Secretary Jay Carney about the apparent contradiction. Carney did repeat the president's assertion that any referendum on the status of Crimea, regardless of the plebiscite's outcome, would be rejected by the administration as unconstitutional. Mark Sloboda is a senior lecturer and researcher on the sociological faculty of Moscow State University. We spoke with him about some of the apparent contradictions in the U.S. position.
Yeah, this is, of course, a piece of egregious geopolitical hypocrisy on the part of the Obama regime. This putsch regime that has taken control, as you rightly noted, by ultra-nationalist mob and paramilitary violence. It has absolutely zero constitutional or democratic legitimacy to occupy Kiev the way it has. They have forged a Rada majority out of literal blackmail, threats to family, beatings of deputies, Rada deputies, on the streets in front of the Rada, and on dragged through and beat, running a gauntlet to the Maidan stage. And that this is not hyperbole. There are plenty of pictures and video. They're quite happy, these people, to post this out there online of what they're doing. Rada deputies who attempted to flee Kiev were seized at the airport by these right sector militants and dragged back. Okay, they are threats are issued to their families. They are, some of them are dragged literally from their homes by these right sector militants, taken to the Rada to vote, and then dragged back.
Wow.
Rada deputies have had their houses, party leaders, have had their houses burned to the ground, and the government has done nothing. There are over 500 now opposition party offices that have been looted, sacked, or burned down in the last 2 weeks. And of course, this putsch government does nothing because it's its own fascist paramilitaries that are doing it. We have an attempt to impeach the only, however imperfect, democratically and elected legitimate president completely outside the bounds of the Ukrainian constitution, in which it is a long and complicated affair that involves going to the constitutional court, hearings, evidence, and so on. And a three-quarters majority in the Rada, which they do not have, because enough of the Rada deputies fled and escaped and have a number of the communists and party of regions and have never returned since. They have changed the Constitution out of the bounds of the constitutional methods of changing the Constitution. They have named their own new Speaker of the House to also be the acting president. This is one man, unelected to the president, who was heading two branches of government and issuing orders for both of them. Newly come to power, they attempted to ban one of the other parties in the RADA. They voted on a ban of the Communist Party, which is still a party of substantial electoral support, particularly in the east and south of the country. These people were acting so out of bounds of the own law and constitution in the name of their revolutionary expediency, that there's no way, shape, or form that any reasonable, objective consideration can anyone consider this putsch regime legitimate.
Yeah, the way it's being portrayed here, the government was driven out by, quote, the people, in other words, a popular uprising, which clearly, you know, was not the case if you look even slightly beneath the surface. Here in the United States, for example, if you were to mobilize the majority of the population of Washington, D.C., which is primarily black and poor, you could probably run the president and the Congress out of town also, and that would represent, however, a small minority of the total population of the United States. That is the democratic underpinning in the narrative coming from Washington, of the putsch that took place. And yet, in the event of a referendum where everyone that lives in Crimea gets to vote, they do not see any democratic legitimacy to that. The Constitution, whichever one may be effective right now, is what takes priority. And this comes, by the way, from an alleged constitutional scholar who's the president of the United States. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, that shows clearly the disconnect between the rhetoric, the democracy promotion rhetoric of the Obama regime and the reality of the hypocrisy on one side and the other of this particular situation.
At today's press conference also, rather than asking questions about this glaring contradiction, there were repeated questions about whether or not Vladimir Putin was on a list of people being sanctioned, as an individual and as an official. Carney and Obama had both said that no one has been sanctioned yet, that this was the action taken, the executive order was simply enabling in case they go that way at some point in the future. But the press seemed preoccupied with the idea of sanctioning Putin. What do you think about that?
Well, of course, the Western mainstream media, they love Vladimir Putin. He is the enemy that allows them to define themselves. They've created a Hollywood villain caricature out of him that really tells us far more about them than it does about Vladimir Putin. It's the enemy that America needs to define itself as a virtuous and freedom-loving and so on, but it bears the little, if any, resemblance to reality. About these sanctions, it should be noted that it was for property and asset seizure in the United States. Well, even if these are enacted, they are, of course, simply a matter of the U.S. government impotently needing to make a gesture of doing something. Because as of presidential order from last year, President Putin demanded that all government officials divest themselves of any assets in foreign countries, particularly the United States. So there's not really anything there to bite. And in fact, the Russian Senate has already drafted counter sanctions on an asymmetrical basis, that if sanctions are put against Russian and Crimean officials, then Russia will react with counter sanctions asymmetrically to seize and nationalize the assets of Western companies within Russia.
And then finally, Hillary Clinton and others have been sort of chasing the proud tradition of American rhetoric the last few days in particular, in the tradition of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi and a host of others, they've been comparing President Putin to Hitler. And I'm wondering about the irony there, given that the people that the U.S. has backed that have taken over the government in Ukraine are avowed Nazis.
Yeah, they are. And that cannot be understated. The Western mainstream media goes to incredible lengths to try to deny the existence of this Bandera-worshipping right sector, of Spilnas Brava, of the Svoboda Party. And it should be noted that the Svoboda Party leader and several of its members were actually banned from the United States not long ago for their anti-Semitic views. But now the United States is doing photo ops with them, and they're sitting in the government in charge of ministries of lustration, the deputy prime minister, which controls intelligence, and the police, and these right sector leaders in charge of the Defense and Security Council. So we've got Banderite ultranationalists and neo-Nazis in this government in charge of all the state organs of power, including the military, the police, the intelligence, and the interior ministry, and this new office of lustration. One of the first legislative priorities of this putsch regime was to remove the ban on Nazi symbology and propaganda. That's one of their first legislative priorities in a divided and bankrupt country. Then that should tell us quite a bit about who these people are and what they represent.
Meanwhile, there was more tough talk from the UK's Prime Minister David Cameron, who warned Russia that it needs to sit down with Ukraine under EU supervision or else.
All the offers last night were on the table about how to create a contact group that includes Ukraine and Russia. That is clearly what needs to happen. It's less important who else is in that contact group. But what matters is that with international support, the Ukrainian government and the Russian government are talking to each other. Frankly, there's no excuse now for that not to happen. And the Russians need to help make that happen. And if they don't, as I've said, consequences will follow.
At an emergency summit in Brussels, leaders from the 28 EU member states said that direct talks between Russia and Ukraine must start within the next few days to defuse the tension. Those negotiations should bear fruit, quote, in a limited time frame, close quote, according to a communique from the group. Absent such talks, the EU said it would consider travel bans on Russian individuals, asset freezes, and cancellation of an EU-Russia summit. Dr. Derek Aver is a senior lecturer in Russian foreign and security policy at the University of Birmingham, who specializes in Russian-European relations. He says diplomacy is needed at this point, and that all parties involved need to hammer out some kind of a deal, even if it's only an interim one, to stave off any further conflict.
Well, certainly diplomacy is needed. It seems to me that given the fairly volatile situation both in Crimea and probably more worrying in eastern Ukraine, that really some kind of deal, even if it's only an interim deal, with the details to be worked out, which at least dampens the situation down, is something which is badly needed. There's definitely the potential for conflict, perhaps even armed conflict in the regions. And, the European Union, together with, obviously, in a larger format with the US and Russia, really needs to hammer out some kind of working framework within which you can then talk about elections for president and prime minister, for perhaps some kind of monitoring mission in the volatile parts of Ukraine, eastern Ukraine and Crimea, and other things like that. There are some divisions between the US and Europe, and some divisions within Europe. Some of the member states of Europe are taking not necessarily an anti-Russian position, but let's say a harder line position, saying that really, Russia should not be able to dictate to Ukraine. In that group, we can probably count the United Kingdom, to an extent Poland, although Poland has the potential to play a leading role. The Baltic states, Sweden. On the other hand, we have, in particular, Germany, and I would think, perhaps Finland as well, two countries which have very good trading relations with Russia. And obviously Finland, you know, has a kind of strategic security, let's say, relationship as well. So I don't think that between these two groups that the ground is unbridgeable. I think it's really that comes down to the detail. But, you know, in answer, you know, what is the alternative? I don't think there is any alternative. Having said that, ultimately, the decisions are going to have to be taken by the Ukrainians. There is going to have to be some kind of accommodation between the interim government and between the pro-Russian or Russian ethnic minorities in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. And that looks more difficult to achieve, particularly as the current interim government, I think, is divided and weak. There is no obvious candidate to take over who might be able to bridge these gaps to keep the situation under control. This facet of the crisis could last for a few months yet, I think.
The Crimean parliament today voted in favor of the region joining Russia. What is your reading of the significance of that and the potential impact it could have on this crisis?
Well, it's obviously a headline development. It really depends on to what extent the members of parliament in Crimea represent the will of the population of Crimea. Obviously, there are ethnic Russians there, pro-Russian factions, but also you have the Crimean Tatars, which I understand are more pro-Ukrainian, or at least they want to retain sovereign Ukrainian state. That's obviously a very big gap, as I say, that needs to be bridged, which is why I've just mentioned, I think that, you know, the talks are going to go on for a long time, and there's potential for renewed, if not overt violence, renewed kind of clashes, renewed conflict. We've seen groups taking government buildings and then being retaken by other groups. If that sort of thing drags on, then really it's going to be a very difficult situation.
And while the U.S. and EU work on various sanctions for Russia and Crimea, two long-term victims of U.S. sanctions are working out economic ties between themselves. An Iranian parliamentary delegation left Tehran for Cuba and Venezuela on Monday and was set to arrive in Havana Thursday. The team's visit to Cuba was intended to accelerate the expansion of relations between Tehran and Havana, according to the Cuban ambassador to Iran. The Iranian delegation was scheduled to travel to Cuba and Venezuela Sunday, but the trip was delayed when U.S. officials told the Russian airline's Aeroflot that its airliner was not allowed to pass through U.S. skies with the Iranian team on board. The Iranian lawmakers set off for the two Latin American countries after a one-day delay, taking a different aerial route than the one previously planned. Five Afghan soldiers were killed in an airstrike by the NATO-led forces in Afghanistan in the eastern Logar province, according to a government report. The reason for the airstrike Thursday was not clear. The NATO-led force in Afghanistan said it was aware of the reports. However, it did not immediately provide any details. Afghan's President Hamid Karzai has ordered an investigation. We have this report from Press TV.
The Afghan government says it's investigating a U.S. drone strike that killed at least five Afghan National Army soldiers. Afghan officials say the deadly airstrike took place in the eastern province of Logar early on Thursday morning. Several more soldiers were also wounded in the attack. The U.S.-led military alliance, NATO, has confirmed the report, calling the deadly drone raid an accident. Ties between Kabul and Washington have already been tense over the killing of civilians by U.S.-led foreign troops. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has defied U.S. calls for signing a deal that allows the presence of American troops in Afghanistan beyond the December 31st deadline.
The premature death of Jackson, Mississippi's Mayor Chokwe Lumumba came weeks before a conference that he called to discuss the alternative vision that he presented for the redevelopment of America's cities. Bruce Dixon is senior editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, and he filed this commentary.
Absolutely nothing underscores the political bankruptcy of our glittering black political class more starkly than its abject failure from the time of the first black big city mayors in the 60s and 70s to the present. From the growth of the Congressional Black Caucus from a handful in 1965 to about 40 at the time of the Katrina disaster and the displacement of half the black population of New Orleans, nothing marks their utter uselessness to black communities more than their failure thus far to come up with any model of urban economic development other than gentrification. the moving of poorer, usually black folks, out of urban neighborhoods to bring richer, often whiter residents, upscale shopping, trendy business, and tourism in. We can't even come close to blaming this on evil, immoral Republicans. Everywhere we look, black Democrats and their appointees have been the prime movers and shakers in displacing the black communities, which provided the very constituencies that voted in black mayors and legislators into office. You can look at Brooklyn or Columbus. You can look at Atlanta or Chicago. You can look at Tampa or Philly or New Orleans. In each and every case, black public officials took it upon themselves to sell the dismantling of public housing and the raising of entire communities as a process to which there was no alternative. But in Jackson, Mississippi last year, longtime radical black activists around Chokwe Lumumba succeeded in winning the mayor's seat. Lumumba died just 8 months into his 4-year term as mayor and will be laid to rest this Saturday. But even before his election, with the negative examples of places like Atlanta before them, the circle around Mayor Lumumba began thinking through not how to govern Jackson, Mississippi, but how to transform it. It's no secret that there were multiple factions inside the administration of Mayor Lumumba. Some of them wanted to make permanent peace and assimilate into the black contingent of Mississippi's Democratic Party, alongside Congressman Bernie Thompson, the ranking Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee. But others around Mayor Lumumba wanted not to govern Jackson as it is, and as the black misleadership class does everywhere else, they insisted and still insist on transforming it. They want to do what the black misleadership class won't do, come up with a model of urban development that is not gentrification, an economic development model that develops poor areas for the people who live there now, not for some class of urban pioneers and tourists you might attract later. This conflict will play out on several levels. A special mayoral election will take place within a few weeks to fill the unexpired term of Mayor Lumumba. Most of the candidates jockeying for office are undoubtedly intent on governing Jackson, not transforming it. There may be one exception, however, but this is not yet clear. What is clear is that the first weekend in May, Jackson will host a Jackson Rising, an economic conference on how to transform a working city for the benefit of those who live there now, a conference on what people's economic development can and ought to look like. These are important questions, vital questions, questions for which our glittering class of black politicians and placeholders across this vast country have no answer, and so will never ask. Black Agenda Report will certainly be there, and the eyes of Black America will be watching carefully. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And we close with this commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal about the late mayor, Chokwe Lumumba.
Chokwe Lumumba, presente. His name was Chokwe Lumumba. And for over 40 years, he was a people's lawyer dedicated to the needs of the black nation. As a young lawyer in Detroit, he worked to defend members of the nationalist group, the Republic of New Africa, after their members were attacked by police and many were arrested back in 1981. When he signed on to defend RNA members, Bilal Sunni Ali and Fulani Sunni Ali, the judge went out of his way to remove him from the case. But Lumumba and the Alis fought to reverse this order, and sure enough, it got reversed. That fierce determination fueled him through an exemplary career in law, and he developed the nationalist practice that attracted radicals and revolutionaries as clients. When famed rapper Tupac Shakur was charged with aggravated assault on several cops, Lumumba represented him and beat the case. When the Scott sisters were fighting an unjust conviction, Chokwe Lumumba convinced the Mississippi governor, Haley Barbour, to free them in 2011 after over 17 years in prison. When he entered electoral politics, Jackson, Mississippi would become his city after election as mayor. He was able, imaginative, and determined. Chokwe Lumumba, after 66 years of life, recently joined his ancestors. He never stopped fighting for the freedom of black people. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.